You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's natural to feel tired if you have a lot going on at work and or at home. But at what point does that become burnout? We'll talk to a psychologist about the best ways to recognize, address, and prevent burnout. Now, the 22nd Amendment was ratified 70 years ago, limiting the president to serving 2 4-year terms. That was a move aimed at preventing any one person from solidifying too much power. But what about one family? The United States has seen its share of powerful political families. The Adamses, Roosevelts, and Bushes all had 2 members serve as president, and others have had a big influence on elections, even when they don't win multiple terms. One political expert says these dynasties are bad for the country, and we should consider passing a new amendment that would bar the spouses, siblings, or children of former presidents from winning the presidency themselves. Philip Wallach is a senior scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he researches the separation of powers and Congress. He wrote about this for Politico magazine. I talked to him in March. Here's our conversation. Well, do you think we have a political dynasty problem here in the country, or at least an issue with presidential families having just a little too much influence?
This was something on my mind in 2015 as we were gearing up for the presidential election the next year. And there looked like a pretty serious possibility that 2016 would be Clinton versus Bush. And I imagined what a school child learning about the American presidency of the late 20th century, early 21st century would learn. And it would be Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, Clinton or Bush. They would think that you had to be a member of one of these two families to become president in our country, which just seemed so awful to me. And obviously that's not how things turned out, but it is the case that Jeb Bush's presence in the 2016 election seriously distorted the contest on the Republican side. And I think it is the case now that people are too ready to think of the Republican Party as the Trump family party, as if somehow this family is likely to just have a lock over the nominations in the years to come. And I think that's immensely unhealthy. And I think it would be good to have an amendment in the Constitution just making it impossible.
Before we get into how an amendment like that might work, let's look at one we already have. The 22nd Amendment says, hey, 2 terms in office and that's it, 2 4-year terms, ratified in 1951 after Franklin Roosevelt had elected 4 terms, served 3 and some of that. Can you talk about the reasoning behind that amendment? And you write, not just as Republicans angry at Roosevelt, but as a tool to keep one figure from dominating American politics.
Sure. So obviously, Franklin Roosevelt was one of this country's greatest presidents, but there were a lot of problematic things about the way he and his administration operated. One of the best illustrations of this comes from 1938, when Roosevelt was under some political pressure, including from members of his own party, and he decided to go after some of the members of his own party, trying to support their primary opponents and get them out of office. For the president to do that would be one thing, but it actually turned out that people who worked for the Works Progress administration, the WPA, were out there working those campaigns, essentially trying to get information out to voters to support Roosevelt's favored candidate. So there was a danger that was perceived by both Democrats and Republicans that FDR was trying to turn the federal government into a kind of giant political machine that would operate on his behalf. And so that led to some changes. It led to something called the Hatch Act of 1938, which you occasionally still hear about in the news today, that says that federal employees are not allowed to get involved in electioneering. It also led to a sort of more general push to depersonalize government and make sure that we got the rule of law and not the rule of men, even from this growing bureaucracy that we had from the New Deal. And so that led to things like the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946.
Talking to Philip Wallach from the American Enterprise Institute, he wrote a piece in Politico magazine saying, we need a new constitutional amendment that says, if you are a spouse or a kid or a sibling of an American president, you don't get to run for president yourself. So I've summed up a couple times, Philip, this idea for a new constitutional amendment. Lay out how you see this working, who in particular would be barred from seeking the White House.
Well, to be honest, I haven't thought through all of the nitty-gritty details, but the general idea is just, yeah, if you're a close family member of somebody who has served as president, we're going to say, sorry, you're not eligible yourself to become president of the United States. And I threw out there spouses, siblings, children, people who have talked to me about this piece and said, what about ex-spouses? I get rid of them too. My feeling is, you know, the contribution that we can get from any of these people is just not necessary for our American Republic to function in a healthy manner. And the cost of having the shadow of these families hang over our politics is really quite immense. And so, you know, there's a certain sense of unfairness. This proposal, I'm surprised how much it does, but it seems to offend people's sense of fairness. Well, they should be allowed to run just like anybody else. That's not what it's about. It's about making sure that our republic functions well, and we would do better without having this family overhang.
Well, I want to give a listen to a woman whose family would have been affected by this amendment, the wife of one president, mom of another, and mom of yet another presidential hopeful. Barbara Bush, former first lady, talking in 2014, asked about the possibility of Jeb Bush running for president. Here's a listen to some of what she had to say.
I think this is a great American country, great country. And if we can't find more than two or three families to run for high office, that's silly, because there are great governors and great eligible people to run. And I think that the Kennedys, Clintons, Bushes, they're just more families than that.
Could you talk about that statement? If we have these dynasties, her concern there in a family that was at the center of this, are we reducing our talent pool for higher office?
Absolutely. That's exactly my argument, is that we are sort of drinking stagnant water when there's no reason for us to do that. It's a huge country with so many talented people, including talented government administrators and managers who would make great presidents. And we need to expand our idea of who ought to be in the presidency rather than just going back to these same families. And I thought Barbara Bush, that interview that you just played a clip from, was right on the money. Unfortunately, she changed her tune, got behind Jeb finally in that campaign in the following election cycle. But I think she nailed it there. We don't need to depend on the same families, and it's an unhealthy tendency that we have to do so.
Why is that? Why do we do that as Americans? In theory, we, you know, the country was started with the idea that we shouldn't be ruled by literal dynasties. Why have we sometimes, do you think, gone back to Adamses and Kennedys and whatnot again and again?
Well, I think there's an undeniable value to the celebrity that being a child of a president can bring someone. And so it just gives someone a real leg up. It gives them something to strive for. And it makes a certain amount of sense just in terms of our human attention spans. But especially in this age of social media, where there's a chance for individuals and families to sort of grab hold of the emotions of their followers and manipulate them on a regular basis, I'm worried that connection is overpowering our more rational impulses to look for the most able men and women to lead our government.
We're listening to my March conversation with Philip Wallach. He's senior scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, looking at a piece he wrote for Politico magazine this spring calling for an amendment to bar close relatives of former presidents from being president themselves. Coming up, we'll hear the second part of the conversation and his take on term limits for congressional lawmakers. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue listening to my March conversation with Philip Wallach, scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He wrote an article for Politico magazine this spring about his idea for a constitutional amendment to prevent close family members of former presidents from running for the White House. We hear the rest of my conversation with him, starting us off, Lynn in Dubuque, who called in to give her opinion on the issue.
I am just overwhelmed at what I'm hearing. How many more changes in the Constitution does the left want? They're just afraid Trump's son or Hunter would get in the next time. And I just can't believe what I'm hearing. Change the Constitution. Change the Constitution. What are you afraid of?
Lynn, thanks for the call. Hunter would be Joe Biden's son, but concern about Donald Trump's children possibly running for office. I don't know. Are you motivated by a perspective coming from the left, Philip?
I'm certainly not. I'm not a man of the left at all myself, and I share the caller's concern for changing the Constitution without thinking about it, but. This is something that I'm trying to ground in a good conservative tradition. That's where the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution came from, and that's where this idea would come from, this idea of what I call anti-Caesarism, this idea that as part of the Republican tradition in America, that's part of our nation's founding, we're against monarchy. We're against the idea of elevating any one family to this place where it can dominate our politics for generations. And I think we should reflect that in the Constitution. So I don't think that that's a radical or certainly not a leftist move. And as I said, this was something I'd been thinking about before Trump ever came onto the political scene.
Thanks for the call, Lynn, at 800-642-1234. And we did have two Bush presidencies, a one-term and a two-term presidency. You know, there were commonalities, of course, in their politics. They also each brought their own perspectives to the table. They were different people. Do you really see that as an example of, you know, a potential slippery slope to Caesarism, to some sort of domination of politics by one family?
Well, listen, I would say plenty of things in defense of both Bush presidencies, and I'm plenty of things critical of them, too. I don't think they were extraordinarily bad presidents, really, by historical standards. But when I think about the Bush family's presence, I really do think about that 2016 election most of all. Think about the way that Jeb Bush's presence in that way drew all this money and attention to him that might well have gone to somebody else who would have been better able to contest that nomination with Donald Trump. I think that would have been a healthier dynamic. Likewise, I think about Hillary Clinton. I think Hillary Clinton, there's a lot to be said for her, but I don't think she was ultimately a very good presidential candidate. And nevertheless, she sort of dominated the conversation about who the next Democratic presidential nominee would be from the time that she became a senator, really. And so in 2008, there she was. And in 2016, she had the nomination. And I just don't think that hanging around those two families was a good thing at all.
Let's go back to our callers now. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi, guys. So I kind of both agree and disagree on this topic. I agree because I don't think we should have dynasties. It's too reminiscent of a monarchy, and that's not what America is. And I kind of agree, too, I kind of disagree because who knows what the kid will be like or the other family member will be like. I think the real problem, though, is that running for office requires too much money, and there are so many people out there that are running for these offices, but they can't afford to put themselves out there. So like your guest said, who might be better able to run the country or run an office? We don't know because we never see most of the people that are out there that are running.
Michael, thanks for that call. And that's an interesting point. And you've kind of touched on this a little bit, Philip, that the bar to running for president is kind of high. It's expensive. And this name recognition of a Clinton or Bush or whatever gives you a certain leg up. Is it a thing where we need to change the process to bring more people into the mix rather than do it by excluding some people with that last name from the mix?
Well, I think we have to look to our parties, who are really the ones most responsible for choosing who ends up on that final ballot. And I think both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have been struggling in recent years to try to figure out, well, how can the party project its own influence and its own sense of who would be a good president into figuring out what that pool of candidates should look like. And mostly they haven't really figured it out. They've mostly found themselves sort of playing defense against outsiders who bring name recognition into that contest. Trump wouldn't have been the first one. You think of Herman Cain in the previous election cycle. And so I do think we need to think about how our two political parties could do a better job supplying us with a pool of talented candidates.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Philip Wallach from the American Enterprise Institute about his concerns about political dynasties in the United States. Maybe a constitutional amendment, he says, to keep spouses, siblings, children of presidents from running for president themselves. Let's go back to your calls. Bev is with us in Dodgeville. Bev, hi.
Hello. My question involves not necessarily the president, but what about the members of Congress? What about a term limit for those individuals? We have people in Congress that have been there. It's like their full-time job. It's their whole career has been there. What about those people? Shouldn't we have some type of term limits on their positions?
Bev, thanks for the call. We started talking about that 22nd Amendment and term limits for presidents, Philip. Bev says, why not members of Congress?
Well, I'm very much against term limits for members of Congress. I think it would end up depriving Congress of some of the most talented and experienced people that give Congress some of its clout to stand up to the White House, which we need more of right now. Congress is really finding itself dominated by the executive branch far too much in our current politics. So I did say in my political piece, I say we could think of extending the same spirit of this amendment to members of Congress. It's a little bit strange how many members of Congress came from political families. That's the biggest way to get a leg up on a congressional seat is to have had somebody from your family be a politician before you. And so I think we could consider extending the family ban to people trying to run for Congress, too, although it wouldn't be a necessary application.
And thanks for that call. Philip, just in our last minute, do you see a way to expand our pipeline of talent, whether we're talking about Congress or White House races, so that it isn't just those people who have that family background in politics that are the first to think of running?
I mean, I think the pools we get are so shaped by the party. So we really, as individuals, we need to think about how to engage with those political parties more. And I think, you know, it's a trend in recent years to see more and more people registering as independent and not as members of parties. And they're sort of against one party more than they are members of another. But I think we need, as citizens, to think about how we interact with those parties, whether they're serving our interests. And if they're not, maybe we need to become more active as citizens in encouraging them to provide us with different kinds of candidates for federal office.
We'll leave it there. Philip, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Philip Wallach is a senior scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he researches the separation of powers and Congress. I talked to him in March about his piece for Politico magazine calling for an amendment barring relatives of former presidents from also running for president. You can find a link to that at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we talk to the author of a new book about the problem of burnout and get her advice on how to prevent it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Give me a minute. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Tell me if this sounds familiar. You've been working just as hard, if not harder, during the pandemic, but you can't find happiness or purpose in your job like you used to. Our next guest says that may be a sign that you're experiencing burnout, something more workers are feeling a year into the pandemic, upending work and personal lives. Jacinta Jimenez is a psychologist, executive coach, and author. Her new book is called The Burnout Fix: Overcome Overwhelm, Beat Busy, and Sustain Success in the New World of Work. I talked to Jacinta in April about her new book. Here's our conversation. Well, this is an important topic to you as a professional, but it was also a personal issue for you. You write in your book. Can you tell us about your own encounter with burnout early in your career?
Yeah. That's a great place to start. I thought it was really important for me to share that burnout can happen to anyone, even someone who is a psychologist. And my burnout experience is really personal in that I was actually pursuing my degree in psychology. I was setting forth my doctoral dissertation. I had the chief of Stanford Psychiatry, the School of Medicine, as my dissertation chair. And I was really self-focused. And then all of a sudden, I got a call from my mom and learned that my brother, who was very young and healthy, was suffering from heart failure. And it was really just the rug was pulled out of me. The work and life had collided full force. And here I was, a graduate student, pursuing to be a doctor. So I'm like, I can do this. I can step up and help my brother's care, because there was a lot of recovery process. It was a big, big deal. Well, still not compromising on pursuing my doctoral education as well, because I'm a first generation Latina. It was very important for me. And so I thought I could do both. And at first I was managing it okay. I tried productivity hacks. I worked harder. I cut down on social time. I shifted my work schedule. But as much as I tried to work harder and smarter, I noticed that my vitality, my overall vibrancy and energy was draining from me. And I had to drop out of a world-renowned psychiatrist, David Byrne's lab, and felt like I just couldn't make progress. And it was really mind-blowing for me to watch myself kind of slowly and not even fully aware until burnout had reached this point that I was burning out and that it was affecting my own health. Yes, my brother's physical health was affected, but my own personal health, my personal well-being and vitality was also affected in it. And it was a really profound experience that made me realize, like, you can't just grate your way through things. Working harder and working smarter are part of the equation. But if we're also not taking care of, you know, our well-being and investing proactively in self-care and resilience, when we are hit with adversity and stressors, that is going to take a toll. And so it was really important for me to kind of dedicate my work towards instilling this idea that mental health isn't just the absence of, or mental well-being or physical well-being isn't just the absence of suffering. It's also about flourishing and thriving and keeping ourselves strong and vibrant in the face of adversity and uncertainty and all the things that we've been experiencing in this past year.
And you bust some myths right off the bat in your book. And you just mentioned self-care as being really important, and it is. But you also say it isn't just about taking care of ourselves. It's about our employers and institutions creating situations where we're not in that burnout situation in the first place. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think it's a misnomer that burnout is just a problem of the individual, that the individual just has to work to be stronger or more resilient and more vibrant. And yes, we can benefit from that. But humans exist in a system, right? We can't look at an individual without looking at the system or environment that they exist in. And we also can't look at the system or work environment without looking at the people and what they're doing to take care of themselves that make up that system. So it's a mutually reinforcing overarching kind of system approach to really treating burnout, where we have to address it at the organizational level while also helping people find ways to foster their resilience and well-being in the process.
And another myth you tackle, every generation has concerns about the kids today. They're soft. They lack discipline. They're not as tough as we used to be. And that's why burnout's increasing. It's not a structural problem. It's a problem with the youth. You say no.
No, yeah. What research has found is that burnout happens when there's a mismatch between our capacities as humans, or the nature of the human, and the nature of work. And given how quickly our world of work is changing at unprecedented paces in so many ways, like I'm in here in San Francisco, I live and breathe in Silicon Valley, and I can attest to how fast things are changing. And as humans, we are not able to adapt as fast to these changing environments that are happening to us. And when that mismatch happens, or that gap grows between, again, our capacities as humans and the nature of our work or environment, that's going to take a toll. So it's not about us not being tough or gritty. It's about that this mismatch is growing. And I tend to think that, you know, we're entering into this new world of work, but unfortunately, many of us and the organizations that we work in are hanging on to outdated formulas of what it takes to be and sustain our success in a new world of work.
Justina Jimenez is with us, psychologist, author of the new book, The Burnout Fix. She's talking about the problem of burnout and how we can tackle it in our work lives, and how employers can help avoid burnout for their employees. Jacinta, it's more than just a scented candle and a nice bath or something like that. You've got a process for evaluating our own burnout, and we could put a lot of work into this. Where do we start? If we start to notice that we have these burnout feelings, what are some of the first steps we can take?
Yes, like one-off coping strategies is not going to solve burnout. Burnout is a very complex problem, and so complex problems require multifaceted integrative solutions. So when you're first noticing it, that's half the battle, because burnout is quite insidious. It sneaks up on you over time. And it's not until it's manifesting really strongly in these like three core components, which is exhaustion, cynicism, where you have low levels of job engagement, and then inefficacy, a lack of productivity or feelings of incompetence. When those three things come together, that's when burnout happens, but we don't almost notice it until it's like really causing problems in our work or personal life. And so that's half the battle, is just realizing it. And then the second thing I would recommend to people is to figure out, so the research has found there's six mismatches, and I can go through them really quickly, that lead to burnout, between that mismatch that I was talking about between a person and their work. And one of them is fairness. So if someone's doing job promotions and you were set up to get that promotion and you didn't get it, that can lead to burnout. The obvious one is workload, right? Too much work, not enough time to do it. But there's not so obvious ones that people may be surprised to learn about, that it's not just I worked myself to exhaustion. Burnout can happen from a breakdown in community, if you have lack of belonging or a caustic work environment. If there's a values misalignment, so your job, you set out to follow the mission of your work, and your boss is telling you to do something that's not aligned with that mission, that will take a toll. And then the other one is reward. So you're not getting adequate reward, and that can be social, intrinsic, and not just economic reward. And then the final one is control. If you're being micromanaged or have little control and lots of uncertainty, that sets up for what psychologists call learned helplessness. And it's like, why even try to make a change at my job if I can't control it? So knowing which of those six mismatches you land on can give you an insight into where to start to address it. And the more granular you can get, the better. So it's not just about I overworked and then I got exhausted. There may be more to it than that. And so having that knowledge can go a long way in empowering you to take the right steps.
Let's bring on a caller. Ross is with us in Middleton. Ross, hello.
Hi, Robin. Hi, guest. So I retired last year, right when the pandemic was revving up. I was in healthcare, and the reason my job got stressful is because you're dealing with people who are in stressful situations, and so you're working with them. And my remedy was to cut back my hours. And I don't know if that's a luxury, because I knew it basically means less money. And so my recommendation that I would try to tell those younger workers before I left, before I retired, is to try to set up your lifestyle in such a way that you don't have to live working full time. That is, if you work full time and you enjoy it and everything's good, but try to live as if you're working, say, 80%, just one or two shifts, which I guess, what would that be? That would be like, if it's a 40-hour week, it might be 32 hours, or just that little bit of extra time really helped in my case.
Ross, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. I appreciate that. Jacinta, what do you think? He retired ultimately, but the idea of I can cut back my hours, I can cut back my expenses to match it. So what do you think of that solution that Ross offers there?
So stress isn't bad. It's chronic stress without recovery that is really the culprit. We were designed as humans to have short periods of stress, but we also had that downtime. So the more we can craft a life, if we do have the luxury of cutting back on hours, that's ideal. But crafting a life in which we can stay in what I call in my first chapter is pace for performance, staying in our stretch zone. So we're not going to our stress zone, but we're still stretching ourselves. We're getting peak productivity, but we're not in that point where we're chronically stressed. So knowing where to stretch to and not stretching beyond that point and working around conditions, whether that is cutting back down on hours or whether that's intentionally setting up little micro moments of pause or respite in between high stress periods at work. If we stay in that chronic stress place, that's where we have excessive fatigue, insomnia, high blood pressure, all those things that happen when we are perpetually feeling nervous system activation. So it makes a lot of sense what Ross said.
And part of how things can go wrong in these situations, you talk about this idea of untidy thinking. What do you mean by that?
Yes. So our minds are our central processing unit, basically, for our experience of the world. And I truly believe, just like we, you know, keep up our dental hygiene by brushing our teeth, or we keep things tidy in our life, we need to be putting as much effort into making sure that our minds are tidy. And that doesn't mean, you know, fully clearing your mind of anything or thinking robotically. It just means paying attention to your thoughts. And the biggest thing I talk about to stave off unhealthy thinking patterns is to really approach your mind, have a mindset of choosing curiosity over concern. So we're wired to not like concern. It's not viable for us, evolutionarily speaking. People rather receive a shock now than have a shock at some point later on in the day because we hate uncertainty so much. But what that does is our mind paints stories to create a sense of uncertainty. And those stories, as we all know, can be accurate or not and cause a lot more stress than we need to. So if we can create curiosity to go, wait, is that story correct? What could be true? And how do I look at this more compassionately? We can save ourselves a lot of actual mental energy.
We are listening to our conversation with Jacinta Jimenez. She's a psychologist, executive coach, and author. She joined us in April to talk about her book, The Burnout Fix: Overcome Overwhelm, Beat Busy, and Sustain Success in the New World of Work. Coming up, we'll hear the rest of our conversation with Jacinta and hear from some Central Time listeners who have experienced burnout and are working to tackle it in their own lives. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue listening to our conversation about the problem with overwork and how to address burnout. Our guest is Jacinta Jimenez. She is a psychologist and author of the new book, The Burnout Fix: Overcome Overwhelm, Beat Busy, and Sustain Success in the New World of Work. I talked to Jacinta in April. We start the next part of our conversation with Jess in De Pere, who called in to talk about balancing work and life, even with reduced working hours.
I have a question kind of related to what the previous caller was talking about, too. I was working full time, doing kind of crisis work with families who are homeless due to domestic violence and sexual assault. And as you can probably hear, I have a 2-year-old in the background. And I just been struggling a lot with trying to keep up and ended up just recently going down to 32 hours. However, I feel no relief, and I might feel, yes, baby, at that chronic fatigue stage already. And I feel like now I'm just still as burned out doing the home life things and work life, but now with less pay. So I'm just wondering if there's any other suggestions you guys may have.
Jess, thanks for the call, and thanks for the important work you're doing. Jacinta, your thoughts for somebody in Jess's position?
Yeah, thank you for the important work you're doing. Yes, when you get to that threshold of extreme exhaustion, it is really tough to bounce back. And this is where I think a huge practice, well, two things. First is just a lot of self-compassion. So there's a lot of research on the art of self-compassion. We are so much harder on ourselves than we are to a friend. And it seems so simple. Just treat yourself like a friend and be compassionate. And when I talk about this with audiences, sometimes I get like, okay, yes, that makes sense, you know. But actually, there's deep, deep research on how, you know, looking at people with brains, looking at them in brain scans to show that this practice of compassion on a daily basis of really being soft with ourselves can give us a little bit of room to have some breathing space versus trying to feel like, okay, I'm still just running against things. The other thing is just, I think it's these micro moments. It doesn't require a huge overhaul and behavior change, but just small mini moments, because it's not realistic and feasible for me to say, hey, well, just go meditate and just go, you know, secure support and do all these things. But if it's small, tiny things that are done on a consistent and persistent basis, whether that's 1 minute to 15 minutes of deep breathing or doing a gratitude practice or just sitting and being very compassionate with yourself, those little things add up to a lot. It's the little things that actually make a difference with behavior change. So I think, but holding that compassion too, because what you're dealing with is significant and real and deserves some compassion as well.
Thanks for that call, Jess, and good luck to you. And let's maybe even hammer that point home a little more, Jacinta, because I could see somebody in a tough situation feeling burnout, feeling it affect their performance, maybe thinking, I have failed. This is a sign that something is wrong with me. And then I could see that making things even worse in this horrible downward spiral.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. And the interesting thing is that research has found that self-compassion has all the benefits of self-esteem without the downsides of self-esteem, because self-esteem comes from like this concept of comparative suffering or looking at someone else, either upward or downward comparisons of people, especially self-esteem. We look down and go, oh, look, I'm doing better than that person. But the moment that we need our self-esteem, we can't look downward to make that downward comparison, which isn't healthy anyway, when we need it most. But compassion is shown just to be as effective as having healthy self-esteem, if not more, because it actually is there whenever you need it. And it's easier said than done for someone like me who thought, well, criticism motivates you, or you've been having tough self conversations motivates me to charge harder. It has been an uncomfortable practice for me, but it has been life-changing. And the research, there's just substantial amounts of research showing how hugely effective this practice can be.
Thanks again for the call, Jess. We're talking to Jacinta Jimenez. Her new book is called The Burnout Fix. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Wausau. Jim, hi.
Hi, hello. Wonderful conversation, and thank you for having me on. Three things. I've been in management a long time, and just through my experiences, three big things that actually changed my life to take out stress. Number one is when I take a little black book with me and I make notes. That way I don't have to worry about mentally juggling all kinds of balls around in my head and to make sure I don't miss things. But along with that, I can write that down. I set that down. It's off my mind because I know I can go back to it at a different time. The second thing is laptops. Unfortunately, we're all strapped with laptops, things like that. I purposely do not bring my laptop home. I used to have a bad habit of doing it, and then I find myself on it. So it's like anything else. If you don't have to be there, don't be there and don't go there. And the third thing, probably most important, listen to your wife. If you happen to have someone in your life that's your conscience, she'll tell you, and she'll say, Jim, we need to have this time. This is not work time. This is our quality time, and it's been wonderful.
Jim, thank you so much. Lots of advice there, Jacinta. What do you think?
Oh, Jim, yeah, I love the the different strategies, because I do want to say that everyone has unique circumstances, life situations, and factors. And so it's about finding that combination that works for you, whether that is having the black book and the lap, you know, not having your laptop with you, or listening to your partner, and having them hold you, you know, keeping you honest about when you need to take a break. That's fantastic. It's about finding the right combination for you about what works. And I definitely love the last piece about listening, you know, to your partner, because just securing support in general is so huge. We're wired to connect. We've survived as a species for centuries in tribes. And so having a support system, or having people to check in with and keep, you know, keep tabs on one another about well-being, can go such a long way in terms of A, normalizing it, that we're all struggling. If you look at the stats, so many people are burning out right now. It's really heartbreaking. It is a major epidemic in itself. The World Health Organization just recognized it. So the more we can find different ways, and also through others, goes a long way in buffering against burnout, or else mitigating the effects of burnout if you're already in it.
Thanks again for that call. Jacinta, in our last couple minutes, I mean, you write about this in the book. There's a work harder mentality. You're in your Silicon Valley, home of the 88, 90 hour work weeks. Young people are told, especially online, you got to hustle. Don't waste any time on yourself. How do you convince people to change that mindset and realize that they actually will accomplish more things by doing less of that kind of thing?
Oh, I'm glad we're ending here. I love this question, because I so adamantly believe that hard work and smart work are only part of the equation for sustainable success. At the end of the day, the research shows us that serious work at a serious time does not come at odds with rest, recovery, or replenishment, or well-being. The two actually go hand in hand. When we are more centered, we're more resilient, we're more vibrant, we do better work. We have higher levels of empathy. We develop more creative solutions. We are more productive. And most importantly, we are healthy, well, and vibrant, and can give back to our families and communities. And everyone ultimately benefits.
It's a great place to leave it. Jacinta, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Such a pleasure to be here.
That was Jacinta Jimenez. She's a psychologist, executive coach, and author of The Burnout Fix: Overcome Overwhelm, Beat Busy, and Sustain Success in the New World of Work. I talked to Jacinta back in April about her book and how we can all recognize and address burnout in our own lives.